Well, this particular book was written during the time immediately following the death of C.S. Lewis's wife, so around 1960. And it is a walk, if you will, very much in the manner of almost a diary of his personal struggle through the grieving process in that particular moment of his life. It was not originally intended for publication. He wasn't writing this for it to become a book originally. He was writing it as kind of a form of catharsis for his own, you know, intake, but was later convinced by a friend and publisher that it might be good for others to have experienced that with him. Now, for those of you who don't know kind of the backstory of his marriage, it's portrayed a little bit in the movie Shadowlands, if you've seen that. It's not fully accurate, but, you know, as most movies are, it's close enough. But it is not what we would call, you know, like a fairy tale romance. The history of this particular union isn't the kind that you normally publish on the front page of your church newsletter. His wife, Joy Davidman, was married prior to their marriage, had two sons in another marriage, and had, from her account, a very tumultuous relationship that her husband was at least verbally, if not physically, abusive, and had several extramarital affairs throughout the time of their union. And so as time progressed and that marriage began to break down, her and her husband actually read Mere Christianity by C.S. Lewis, and she became completely enthralled, not with just the subject matter, but with the author, interestingly enough. Her and her husband converted to Christianity at that point in their marriage, late 40s, early 50s, joined a Presbyterian church. His last name was Gresham, interestingly enough. They joined a Presbyterian church where she began to pursue Christianity and at the same time continue her fascination with L. Ron Hubbard and also pursue Scientology. So she wasn't, you know, necessarily the most orthodox of folks at that particular period of time. That said, not all of the details are known, and even Lewis, in writing her ex-husband after her death, says very frankly to him, "I don't know how to take sides in what happened in your relationship," because he basically acknowledges, "I know that I only received her side of the story, which I know after knowing her these years, even though he deeply loved her, he felt was probably a tainted retelling of all that had transpired in America." Long story short, in 1952-ish, she leaves her husband, moves to England with, you know, which would later come out with kind of an unhidden to some plan of pursuing this bachelor, C.S. Lewis, who had never been somehow wooed by a woman. She was convinced that she would be the one to do that, and surprisingly was. The relationship did not start out romantic in any way, shape, or form. They were friends. He found her a fascinating conversation partner. She moved into his neighborhood, but eventually she was not granted basically a work or stay visa in England and was going to have to go back to the United States. And so C.S. Lewis decided, well, I will marry her, but just kind of in this legal contract. I don't have any necessarily romantic interest in her, but I don't want to see her have to go back to America, at which point all of his friends protested. They were not at all keen to his decision, both because of how it aligned with his Christian faith. They said, you know, that's an abuse of the institution of marriage. If you don't pursue, you know, intend on pursuing her romantically and the like, that is just not fit for, that's not what biblical marriage is. So, you know, Dorothy Sayers' husband came against him pretty strongly. His own brother rebuked him pretty harshly. Long story short, after, you know, several months of kind of this tumultuous back and forth, he did decide to pursue her in marriage. And as you find, even throughout the reading of this book, what began as an intent for a civil union merely to keep her in the country really did become what by all respects would be, you know, considered a romantic or a biblical marriage, that it was not merely something that stayed on the plane of friendship or mere distance. And as you read this book, you'll realize it really was something that took on, you know, great depths as far as their intimacy and union in that way. So again, what worries me or troubles me about giving the background is people think, well, because the story is so messy, then you can't learn anything from it. But, you know, if you read the Bible, you realize most of our history as Christian folks looks something similar to that messy when it comes to how we live our lives out in the real world. Well, all that to say, this book was written after her death. I think we'll see some of the intimacy of their relationship when we read certain passages from it. And it was decided, finally, that it would be published. This raw kind of experience of his own grief would be put out before the watching world. But Lewis, you know, ever the Englishman, said that he did not want his name attached to the book. Now, what do you think his reason for that was? I find this so fascinating. Yeah, it's interesting. That's what you would think. That's what I thought. But it was he didn't want to embarrass his friends by the fact that he would be expressing this kind of emotion, and then the next time they saw him, they would feel compelled to ask him how he's doing because they've read this book and they know he's going through all this. And he says, you know, that's not fair to them to upset them like that and to feel like they've got to, you know, somehow get into all my feelings every time we're encountering one another. And so he decided that it would be published under a pseudonym and not use his name. The original pseudonym was Domitius, which literally rendered from the Latin is halved. So he's writing it as a person who's been cut in half, right? So he's had this one flesh union, and now that his wife is gone, this one who is in half is now writing this story about his grief. The publisher thought that was a bad idea, and he said, if you really want to remain anonymous, that's not helpful because everyone's going to try to guess who actually wrote this book once they see this particular name. So they said, you need to kind of, you know, find a more proper English name that people would believe could be an actual author. And so he published it under the name N.W. Clerk, which was a pseudonym that he used previously at one time in his writing. And it literally stands for Nat Wilk, which roughly translated is I know not whom. And then the final last name, Clerk, simply means writer. Or in one sense, someone who publishes. So I know not whom wrote this particular book was the name that he used for his when he published it under another name. Oddly and somewhat ironically, when several people read the book when finally published, they decided to take it upon themselves to send it to C.S. Lewis in hopes that it would help him with his grieving. Which would have, I think, probably cost him some bit of joy. It was after his death that the publisher approached the trust and asked if they could publish it under his actual name. And their reason was not because they wanted to bear the gory details, but they felt it was a book that would get lost in history if people didn't hear that C.S. Lewis had written it and therefore take it up again with the hopes of maybe gleaning something from it. And it's interesting, the debate that goes back and forth from the trust and the publisher. They said, this is not an easy decision for us, the trust said. They said, for the poet should be spectacles through which people can see the world. He should not become the spectacle. You know, so their fear was that Lewis would be put out there so raw that it would be something where he is being, you know, examined and kind of looked over as opposed to being a vehicle for people to see life as it really is. But they went on to say that without this book, they felt that it would be, you know, that his actual purpose as a poet in that sense would be diminished if people did not take up this particular subject and read it. So with that as a way of background, this is a hard book to kind of just say, hey, this is what the book's about, because it's real simple what it's about. So there's going to be a lot of reading of sections to kind of give you a taste and a flavor for what Lewis is doing here. But the book is broken into four different parts. And you can kind of see the movement in his own grief through these parts. And if, you know, you're going to put names on them, you know, that first part would be kind of the trough of despair or, you know, the descent. Where he really is struggling, not only with the death of his wife, but what it means for him as a person and what it means for him and his belief in God in particular. Part two is the climb, you know, where he's trying to come out of this particular pit. And that is a section that you see there's like slight glimmers of hope in it, and then he'll go straight back into where he was, if not worse, at times. And then finally, thirdly, a slow ascent where he begins to kind of reconsider what will life be like now, now that this is my reality, now that I know that God is real, but I'm not sure I'm comforted by that, until finally there is a bit of a dawning in that fourth section. And so let's look. I want to kind of give you again a flavor of these sections one at a time. And as we do so, just kind of talk about what is being taught through the process of grief, and then just kind of how he comes out on the other side, I think, is very helpful as well. The book opens in this particular way. No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I'm not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning I keep on swallowing. At other times, it feels like being mildly drunk or concussed. There's a sort of invisible blanket between the world and me. I find it hard to take in what anyone says, or perhaps hard to want to take it in. It is so uninteresting. Yet I want the others to be about me. I dread the moment when the house is empty. If only they would talk to one another and not to me. He goes on. He says, on the rebound, one passes into tears and pathos, model in tears. I almost prefer the moments of agony. They are at least clean and honest, but the bath of self-pity, the wallow, the loathsome, sticky, sweet pleasure of indulging it, that disgusts me. And even while I'm doing it, I know it leads me to misinterpret H herself. That's his wife in this book. Give that mood its head, and in a few minutes I shall have substituted for the real woman a mere doll to be blubbered over. Thank God the memory of her is still too strong. Will it always be too strong to let me get away with it? He struggles throughout the entirety of this book, and you'll kind of see there's a few themes that he covers in it. And one of the themes that he covers is the difficulty of the memory of the dead. And he says, you know, what's hard is when you're deep in your grief, you begin to realize you can't quite make out what they actually looked like. And he says, I have pictures of her, but none of the pictures actually capture who she was or what she really looked like, you know, the changes of expressions and the moods. And he says, you know, I can still hear her voice clearly, but I can't see her face. What's going to happen if this is in the first few months over the periods of time? You know, will I forget her altogether? He says, or worse, will I create this new person in my mind that she never was, forgetting all of the realities of a whole human person, the good and the bad? Will I, you know, basically turn her into a doll or some sort of saint that she wasn't? And in that way, not love her, but love this thing that's created in my own mind, almost this egotistic view of the other. And that is something, again, that ebbs and flows through the books and book that needs to be kept in mind as you hear some of these quotes. A few more quick sections in this first part, just again, I think, to give you some of where this particular book takes you emotionally. He says, no one ever told me about the laziness of grief. Except at my job, where the machine seems to run on much as usual, I loathe the slightest effort. Not only writing, but even reading a letter is too much, even shaving. I mean, what does it matter now whether my cheek is rough or smooth? They say an unhappy man wants distractions, something to take him out of himself. Only as a dog-tired man wants an extra blanket on a cold night. He'd rather lie there shivering than get up and find one. It's easy to see why the lonely become untidy, and then finally dirty and disgusting. Meanwhile, where is God? This is one of the most disquieting symptoms. When you are happy, so happy that you have no sense of needing Him, so happy that you're tempted to feel His claims upon you as an interruption. If you remember yourself and you turn to Him with gratitude and praise, you will be, or so it feels, welcomed with open arms. But go to Him when your need is desperate, when all other help is vain, And what do you find? A door slammed in your face and the sound of bolting and double bolting on the inside. After that, silence. You may as well turn away. The longer you wait, the more emphatic the silence will become. There are no lights in the windows. It might be an empty house. Was it ever inhabited? It seemed so once. And that seeming was as strong as this. What can this mean? Why is he so present a commander in our time of prosperity and so very absent a help in time of trouble? This really becomes, again, the main theme of the book, with there are several sub-themes in it. But, you know, A, you know, where is God in our grief? And B, if, you know, A, is there a God because of what we see or, you know, how hard it is to grieve? And B, if there is a God, what kind of God does that make him? A question that he poses very early in this section, and again, I want to read this mainly because this is the kind of core that pushes the rest of this book forward. Not that I am, I think, in much danger of ceasing to believe in God. The real danger is of coming to believe such dreadful things about him. The conclusion I dread is not, so there is no God after all, but, so this is what God's really like. Deceive yourself no longer. And again, this will turn at some point in this book, but I think what is helpful about the fact that not only that C.S., you know, felt this and wrote this, but that it is published, that this is a sincere engagement with what real grief feels like. You know, you'll notice that he's not, you know, sugarcoating the realities of how he's feeling at this present moment. It's not like, well, you know, I feel this way, but I know, you know, that God is good, and therefore I have to, you know, pretend that I'm not feeling this sort of thing. Instead, he's saying, like, look, I feel, you know, in the depths of despair, I've gone to God, and he has been no comfort to me, at least that I can sense at this particular moment. Again, he was going to reflect back on this later in the book, and he says, you know, man, boy, was I like an emotional wreck when I was writing that stuff. And, you know, it's an interesting interplay in his own mind, which I think most of us can agree with. He's saying, you know, sometimes you say something, and it just feels better to say it, even if you don't deep down fully believe it, you know. There's something about just getting something off of your chest. And so part of what he's doing there is surely that, but it's also part that he does not sense the presence of God in his grief. And the idea, you know, that God delivers us from all evil by, you know, always, you know, filling us with, you know, warm feelings and shining light just isn't the truth of Scripture. That the reality of the seeming absence of God is something that the Bible even tells us about. You know, Psalm 88, very much in one sense, is the grief observed way ahead of time. You know, where the psalmist pleads with God and talks about, you know, the evils of the world and his seemingly emptiness and why, you know, it seems that good loses and evil triumphs. And instead of any resolution at the end of the psalm, it just says, you know, I guess this is the way things are. And, you know, full stop. Well, why is the psalmist allowed to write that? And why does the Bible let that into the Bible? You know, if you wanted better press, you could leave those sort of things out. Because those are real human experiences. And the God of the Scripture is big enough to, if you will, receive, you know, the slaps of the two-year-old and not get angered by it in one sense. Meaning, you know, us and our little humanity with some of our revolting against him and some of our questioning, thankfully he doesn't, you know, smack us down. Instead, he lets us question even his goodness in knowledge that he can prove himself to us. That it's not that, again, he has anything to hide or to shy away from. In the second section, once he has kind of, again, stated these two main things, one, where is God in the grieving process, you know, two, what does it mean to lose a person, and, you know, the idea that she's in your memories, he has got a great section, I think that is in part two right here. He says, you know, that's of no help to me. Like, I don't want her in my memories, you know, I want to hold her hand, you know, I want to hear her conversation. The idea that she's alive in your memories, he says, you know, that is cold comfort for someone who lived with a human being. You know, that's not the sort of comfort that I want. And again, I think one thing that's helpful about the book is just to read it to remind yourself not to say dumb things when someone's going through a real tragedy. You know, it's like the best thing you can do is just be there and don't say anything at all. He begins the second section, I think, with an interesting first paragraph. For the first time, I've looked back and read these notes. So he read his first chapter. They appall me. From the way I've been talking, anyone would think that H's death mattered chiefly because of its effect on me. Her point of view seems to have dropped out of sight. Have I forgotten the moment of bitterness when she cried out, and there was so much to live for? Happiness had not come to her early in life. 1,000 years of it would not have made her blasé. Her palate for all the joys of sense and intellect and spirit was fresh and unspoiled. Nothing would have been wasted on her. She liked more things and liked them more than anyone I have known. A noble hunger, long unsatisfied, met at last its proper food, and almost instantly the food was snatched away. Fate, or whatever it is, delights to produce a great capacity and then frustrate it. Beethoven went deaf. By our standards, a mean joke, the monkey trick of a spiteful imbecile. Now, again, some of the language gets what we would, I think most of us say, is blasphemous. He'll address it himself later on, as I said. He goes on, yes, that sounds very well. He says, I must think more about H and less about myself. That sounds very well, but there's a snag. I'm thinking about her nearly always, thinking of the H, the facts, real words, looks, laughs, and actions of hers. But it is my own mind that selects and groups them. Already, less than a month after her death, I can feel the slow and insidious beginning of a process that will make H, I think, that will make the H, I think of into a more and more imaginary woman. Founded on fact, no doubt, I shall put in nothing fictitious, or I hope I shan't. But won't the composition inevitably become more and more my own composition? The reality is no longer there to check me, to pull me up short, as the real H so often did, so unexpectedly, by being so thoroughly herself and not me. So you say, you know, the problem is I'm going to interject me into all my memories of her. And what was great about her is that she wouldn't let me just be me. She would tell me, you know, where I fell short. What pitiable can't to say, she shall live forever in my memory. Live? That is exactly what she won't do. You might as well think that the old Egyptians, like the old Egyptians, that you can keep the dead by embalming them. Will nothing persuade us that they are gone? What's left? A corpse, a memory, and in some versions a ghost. All mockeries or horrors. 3 more ways of spelling the word dead. It was H I loved. As if I wanted to fall in love with my memory of her, an image in my own mind, it would be a sort of strange incest. So as he goes on in this section, he really has this struggle with, you know, his own selfishness and grief, wanting to love her and honor her, but at the same time missing her so bad that he can't help in one sense be self-indulgent, both about how he feels about it, but also about how he perceives her and why her missing really is a tragedy for him. You know, he wants to kind of also say, well, what about her? What about her hopes and dreams and so forth? It's in the midst of this that, again, he begins to struggle with what his faith means when he becomes at least seemingly embittered by her loss. He goes on to say, only real risks tests the reality of a belief. Apparently the faith, I thought it faith, which enables me to pray for the other dead has seemed strong only because I have never really cared, not desperately, whether they existed or not. Yet I thought they did. Yet I thought I did. So notice what he's saying. He said, yeah, you know, I believed all these things about God, and when other people died, you know, I could pray for them and their families. And so he said, you know, the reason I could do it, because I didn't really care that much about them. He's like, I'm beginning to realize they just didn't mean that much to me. but because she really means something to me, now all of a sudden my faith is put to the test, and he says, I can't do it. I can't find myself thanking God for this particular circumstance or praying for those in the midst of it. He goes on to say, talk to me about the truth of religion and I'll listen gladly. Talk to me about the duty of religion and I will listen submissively. But don't come talking to me about the consolations of religion or I shall suspect that you just don't understand. He goes on, and again, this is him struggling with the fact of like, where is God in the midst of all this? I thought I'm supposed to be comforted in this, and it is not taking away the pain. And he says, I think in relation to his brother, though he doesn't quite tell. And poor C quotes to me, do not mourn like those who have no hope. It astonishes me the way we are invited to apply to ourselves words so obviously addressed to our betters. When St. Paul says, what St. Paul says can comfort only those who love God better than the dead, and the dead better than themselves. If a mother is mourning not for what she has lost, but for what her dead child has lost, it is a comfort to believe that the child has not lost the end for which it was created. It is a comfort to believe that she herself, in losing her chief or only natural happiness, has not lost a greater thing, that she may still hope to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. A comfort to the God-aimed eternal spirit within her, but not a comfort to her motherhood. The specifically maternal happiness, that must be written off. Never in any place or time will she have her son on her knees, or bathe him, or tell him a story, or plan for his future, or see her grandchild. You know, and again, he's having this struggle of, yeah, like I get it, in the eternal things, this is a comfort to us. He says, but as regards our humanity, the people that God made us in His image, in this life, it is no comfort at all, that those things are really lost. And this is something I think that is lost currently in American culture in how we grieve. You know, we don't even have, you know, a place to grieve anymore, even at our funerals, as we've talked about in the past. These have to be celebrations of life because, God forbid, we talk about the true pity and shame that we've lost someone in our midst. But the reason why death is an enemy is because it really does tear away life from the community, right? Someone that you could see and touch and have conversation with and enjoy life with, that will never happen again. And that really is something to be grieved over, which is what Lewis is trying to say here. Like, don't just talk to me about eternal platitudes without also acknowledging that there is something really lost here. I will never share again in marital love with her. I will never have those conversations again. We will never hold hands again, you know. And while, she, you know, when we get to heaven, if I was spiritual enough to be able to only, you know, set my mind on the glory that is to be, yes, it's something to be rejoiced in. But there's also this other reality that the pains of this life are still left with me, and those are things that have to be dealt with. And again, I think there are ways to hold both at once, but this is a man really in the midst of that process, not trying to write a theology of holistic grief, right? He's going to get there by the end, but this is really him just saying, this is how I feel today, and don't try to make me feel better by quoting me a Bible verse at this current moment. He goes on, because she's in God's hands, some say. But if so, she was in God's hands all the time. And I've seen what they did to her here. Now, mind you, she struggled with cancer. She struggled with rheumatism first, got cancer, went into remission for a whole year, and they thought she was cured. And then it returned so ferociously that she died within months. And so there was this, to him, in the first chapter, he says, you know, were you just playing with me? You gave her back only just to take her away again in a more, you know, they'd already kind of come to terms with she is dying, and then they have to come to terms with the fact of, you know, no, she's been granted life again to then be again reinterrupted with the sad reality of her death. So he goes on, you know, I've seen what they did to her here. Do they suddenly become gentler to us the moment we are out of the body? And if so, why? If God's goodness is inconsistent with hurting us, then either God is not good or there is no God, for in the life, for in the only life we know, he hurts us beyond our worst fears, beyond all that we can imagine. If it is consistent with hurting us, then he may hurt us after death as unendurably as before it. Sometimes it's hard not to say, God forgive God. Sometimes it's hard to say so much. But if our faith is true, he didn't. He crucified him. And it's interesting, it's that moment in this particular text that the theology that he comes to at the end of this text really begins to poke its head through. You know, in the midst of all of his anger, and you can definitely hear it there, he says, you know, it's almost, you know, if God's good, but he hurts us here, what's going to keep him from hurting us in heaven? He's the same good God, you know. And he says, makes you want to throw up your hands and say, well, you know, I guess we're just going to have to forgive God then. You know, God, please forgive God because he... But what is his theological conclusion there? He said, but God didn't forgive God. He crucified him. You know, it's this glimmer of the fact of like the only way to know that God is truly good is not by judging by sense experience, because there's plenty of things in life that if all you have is the tangible experience, it's like, I don't know. Because God's not giving us the whole story end to the beginning, it's hard to interpret specific circumstances and say, well, of course I can see the goodness of God in cancer when my wife's dying. Like, that's just not a logical conclusion. The only way to interpret that experience with any kind of confidence about God is to look at the cross and say, I know that horrendous experience. God put to death in human flesh for sinful man, receiving a punishment he did not earn or deserve. That displays to me that God is willing to go to any lengths to do good unto us in the end. And therefore, while I can't understand it in these particular circumstances, that horrendous experience and the fact that God entered into it for our sake and he could have remained distant proves to me that God must be good even in the fact that I can't, even when I can't understand the details of, you know, my suffering in this present age. I need to speed up. Okay. So you'll notice he's struggling with the basic questions that I think most struggle with, both believer and unbeliever. The question of God's goodness or theodicy, you know, why God does seemingly evil things. And yet, he's at this point anyway not come to any firm conclusion. He has some very masterful sections there that I can't fully read, but, you know, he says he feels like, you know, a ship that once had, you know, a great engine because it was powered by these two, but now that she's died, that he's powered just by that, you know, the little dummy motor on the back for when you break down. He says, you know, I just am not who I was anymore because of the loss of this particular person. As he goes on to section three, I really need to be careful here. I got 5 minutes. Well, we better start going toward the end. All I can say is you read section three. It's great. He does start to say, you know, all my normal joys in life are gone, not because they've disappeared, but they're not joyful to me anymore. I can't experience the things of this life the way I used to. He says, I even went back and I said, well, let me revisit the days of my bachelorhood. What were the things I enjoyed then? He says, I went back to them and he says, I don't want to be that guy anymore. I'm not him anymore because I was married to you, and I don't want to be him anymore because those things would bring me no joy. So he's like, you know, now I'm stuck in this in-between life where I can't go back to who I was and have any joy. I can't enjoy where I'm at now because you're not here. You know, who will I become in this particular process? Then he talks about his passage from raging at God. Then he says, he even talks about his own abusing of God. And then he does this interesting thing. He says, you know, I'm afraid that she's in your hands, and I know that you promise that you're going to make her perfected. And he says, you know, but again, it was your hands who put her through this suffering process. And he says, if she had to suffer anymore, I would be willing to take that suffering myself. You know, I don't, and he goes, I don't know the rules, but I would be willing to do it. And he goes on to confess, while he's not sure of that, he says he does know that it was allowed to one, we are told. And because that one did suffer because of his love for the other. So notice what he's saying. He said, I love her so much, I would suffer for her. And all of a sudden he says, and that makes me realize that Christ somehow loved us so much that he said, I will bear their suffering. He says, and now I find I can believe again. For he has done vicariously whatever can be done. He says, you know, whatever it is, however suffering works in this life, he says, what I know is that this one loved his bride so much that he bore her suffering on her behalf. And somehow that must lead to this greater happy ending. He then begins to talk about out loud. He says, I realize that in my grief, I was talking so much that maybe the God who was trying to comfort me couldn't even get a word in edgewise because I was too busy, you know, railing against him. But he says, it's hard not to because I'm like an amputee, you know. He says, every day I wake up and I wonder where my arm went because I still want to make use of it, but, you know, she's not here. And he then acknowledges, you know, and the fact is I will never be a whole man again. Like, I will always have a missing limb. And that's just the, and he says, I'm having to start to accept the fact that this is life for me now, and that this is part of the process. But he says, you know, even that and the fact that I don't wake up every morning in the same pain I was in chapter one, railing against God, he says, even that has its own consequence because then you feel guilty. He says, you know, do I not love her like I once did? Because now I feel kind of okay on a Monday morning and the sun's shining and I'm enjoying something. He says, you know, now I feel blame, like, you know, that's me somehow detaching myself from her loss. So he says, quote, still there is no denying that in some sense I feel better. And with that comes some sort of shame. Only to confess, he goes on, that pain is part of the loving process. And any love that is real must be glorified in some sense through pain. And as he goes into that last chapter, or last section, section 4, which is fairly short, we still don't have time to read much of it, but I am going to read the last page. He does say, you know, I've gone back, and it is no longer a locked door. You know, what he'd said about, you know, you go to God in your pain, and you knock on the door, and, you know, you get it locked, shut in your face, and bolted and double bolted. He says, it's no longer a locked door. He says, I no longer fear a false memory of my wife in the sense that I know, you know, that God is keeping her and he has perfected her, and that our love somehow will be exalted in heaven. He knows that it won't be the same, but he knows somehow he will know her better even than, you know, even as he fears, you know, losing his memory of her. And looking back, he says, you know, what I failed to do in my grief was praise God or my wife. He said, and that was foolish because praise gets you to stop thinking about yourself, right? Think about the other, and at least there's a little spark of joy as you remember the other in a praiseworthy manner. And now he says he sees God's hands as merciful and that he's likely fashioned his wife into some sort of weapon to use in his own warfare. But he says the operation that God does in us is more painful than he could have imagined. And he says that this truth has finally been made known to him, that while the grieving process is horrible, he says he can truly confess and believe all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of thing shall be well. He says, at the end of the day, I know that because of the cross, because of God's goodness that he's shown us through that event, that somehow, even though I don't understand it and I don't feel it, everything will be resolved rightly in a manner that I can't fully comprehend. And so I want to read this last page, and hopefully it will communicate as well as it should without me going into the whole subject. He's talking about the beatific vision and some of the debate that goes on with what that event is like when we behold God, that blessed sight, and how we are changed and so forth. He says, once very near the end, I said, if you can, if it is allowed, come to me when I too am on my deathbed. So he's speaking to his wife while she's on her deathbed. He says, if you can, if it's allowed, come to me when I too am on my deathbed. Allowed? She said. Heaven would have a job to hold me, and as for hell, I'd break it into bits. She knew she was speaking kind of mythological language. with even an element of comedy in it. There was a twinkle as well as a tear in her eye. But there was no myth and no joke about the will, deeper than any feeling that flashed through her. But I mustn't, because I've come to misunderstand a little less completely what a pure intelligence might be. Lean over too far. There is also, whatever it means, the resurrection of the body. We cannot understand. The best is perhaps what we understand least. Didn't people dispute once whether the final vision of God was more an act of the intelligence or of love? That is probably another of the nonsense questions. Listen here. How wicked it would be, if we could, to call the dead back. She said, not to me, but to the chaplain. I'm at peace with God. And she smiled, but not at me. Interesting that, as she's going to meet God, she can declare, and this is what I think got Lewis, is that she can confess that she's at peace, and as she's facing or turning toward God in peace, that she has joy. And there was something about that, he realizes that in that moment, she's looking past him, that he's become, in one sense, a faint vision in comparison to the vision she has as she's beginning to behold or about to behold the face of God. And in that smiling, clearly there was a smile that was directed back at her. And for Lewis, that really became his great comfort, that in one sense, she loved something more than him, this God who he had, struggled with in these first chapters. And that someone that she loved more than him was the thing that he then could have confidence that her joy really was being made complete as his would as well.